One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Howdy, everybody, and thanks for joining us here again on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and joining me, of course, as always, Mr. I've been traveling a lot here lately, Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I had a wonderful weekend in San Antonio with my family. We went to SeaWorld, we went to Schlitterbahn, and we went to explore some caverns with the boys, and they really had a really good time. Their favorite part was just mining for gems, which is probably the cheapest thing we did yet.
Right, yeah.
But the weather was nice. The temperature had come down. A cold front came through. And I mean, I don't think it got above like 83 degrees. It was awesome.
Ooh, I love San Antonio, too. Good food.
Yep. We're glad to be home. And schools is starting officially today. So.
Today here in Texas. Everybody else that's there, I hope nobody had too much of a hard time. If they sent their little ones off for the first time to school, that can always be a little bit rough. It's always tough. And it gets tough when you get older. My daughter started sophomore year in high school today. And I'd like to tell her happy birthday. Today's her birthday. So. It's rough. I don't like it. I don't care about me getting older. I still like watching the kids grow up. It makes me sad. But anyway, we're going to shake this sadness off because Kyle, for those of you that don't know, is a very accomplished painter. And he paints all kinds of articles and all these things. And what was it? Bob Ross. Wasn't that the man that you wanted to model yourself after? And he likes, Kyle loves the land of happy little trees.
What was the other guy? What was the old, like, German guy that used to go, fire it in? Remember?
Oh, yeah, I remember that guy.
William Alexander, was that his
name? Yeah, because I think he had brushes. I think my grandmother had those brushes. Anyway, folks, I'm pulling your leg. Kyle is not a painter. He has no artistic bone in his body. But anyway, he's found somebody that painted somebody like, paint me one of your French girls, Kyle. Tell him this story.
Yeah, check this out. This comes from our friend Paul Seaburn over at the Mysterious Universe website. And it's about how a Yeti posed for a portrait by this Russian artist.
Ooh, very nice.
Now it says, you hear it all the time. If you don't have a photo or video of Sasquatch or something like that, well, then I guess it didn't happen. But maybe if he didn't get a painting or a drawing, it didn't happen in this case. It says, a well-known artist in Russia, he didn't have a camera or a cell phone when he met a Yeti, but he did have a pencil and some birch bark. Now, he convinced the abominable snowman to sit down and pose, and he brought back an excellent drawing he made of this Yeti.
Nice drawing.
The creature even signed it.
Wait, what?
Right?
Come on.
Now, this guy's name is Andrei Lyubchenko, and he's a renowned artist and sculptor in Russia. Now, it says, at 5 a.m. on July 27th, 2015, he was alone in a remote area.
Vodka drunk.
Near the Chernivka
I'm not buying this.
Mountain range, gathering wood to sculpt when he encountered a Yeti. Now, he described it as being 2.5 meters tall, thick, dark brown hair like a bear's, but softer. And he said his eyes were just like those that looked just like a human being's. He said, on the other hand, he said that it was a body shape was in very good shape and it had a lot of visible muscles. He says he was pretty sure it was male, and he says its face was very expressive. Now, Lubachenko asked the Yeti its name, and it told him Taban. And the artist described his voice as the sound of a tambourine. What does that mean?
So this Yeti understands Russian.
I guess so. He said he found out later that Taban can mean the one who wasn't discovered in the Shor language of Siberia. Now, he says while they didn't talk, he believes they communicated telepathically for about 40 minutes. And it was during that time that he drew the picture of the Yeti on the bark of a birch tree. Now, Lubachenko says he showed it to him, and the Yeti made his own mark next to it. The mark that the artist says is similar to a symbol of friendship. So he actually signed it. Now, he says, Lubachenko says, he doesn't use alcohol or drugs, and he feared his reputation would be tarnished with this revelation, but he decided that it was too important not to come forward with the portrait. And they got, of course, a picture here of the portrait. I mean, I hate to say I don't believe this story, but I don't believe this story. I mean, a guy comes back with a drawing and says he got a Yeti to sit down and pose for him while he drew it. Come on, man.
Yeah. That's a bit... Dude...
I'm sorry. I try to stay open-minded. This is expanded perspectives, but there is a limit. There's a limit.
Is this your jumping off point?
Yeah, that's too much.
You're not buying it that a guy took a
pencil. Smell that?
Yeah. Took a pencil and some birch bark and was drinking high dollar Russo Baltique vodka.
No, he wasn't drinking. He doesn't drink alcohol.
Alleged.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Alleged.
Yes.
Alleged, yeah. Look, I ain't hating on the guy. I love the story. It's awesome.
Well, it's a good drawing.
Well, yeah, it's a very good drawing, but you don't have to see one to draw one that you know, we don't have anything to compare it to, so you have to go off the idea of what it is. So, look, I don't know. Like you said, it's expanded perspectives. Folks, I don't know, but it is a great story.
You're right.
Of this guy. And the Taban.
Yeah, that's its name.
I'm gonna try to get my grandkids named Taban. At least right. That's what I'm going to start calling your youngest Taban. The one that wasn't discovered.
Yeah.
That's him, Taban. Yeah. We're going to shift gears here, folks. This comes from Phantoms and Monsters. Now, this I'm going to tell you this story first to get into one that just recently happened. But this story actually took place in the Cabwelingo State Forest in West Virginia. Now, it says this happened to the writer that wrote in about this when they were 14. It says every August, my family, my aunt and uncle, and my cousins would spend a week camping in the state forest there in West Virginia in the Cabwelingo. It was a tradition because my grandparents used to do the same thing when they were raising my dad and my aunt, except we were using campers. But back then, we could take our bikes along and go all over the place, you know, typically, I guess, like kids would always do, like we would do. But he goes on to say, or the writer goes on to say, that in the summer of 91, my cousins, two boys, we were all within 3 years of age of each other, decided to go to an area we had never been before. I remembered seeing a trail sign that had Sleepy Hollow on it, so I suppose that was the name of the area. Most of the trail was along a small creek, and it was a very thick forest. It was around noontime, and it had been overcast all day. We were raised in a rural area, so our parents didn't worry too much about us exploring the park. There was a group of large rocks near the trail, so we decided to stop and take a look. We were just jabbering when we noticed a loud humming sound coming from above us. We looked up into the trees and we were hit in the face with what I describe as a blast of energy. All I can remember is my cousins yelling at me because I'd been knocked out. I asked them what happened and they said they were knocked out as well. We started to get scared because everything around us seemed different than before, so we headed back to the campsite. And when we got back, my mom asked me, "Why didn't you come back for dinner?" I looked at my watch and it was gone. I hadn't even noticed. She told me it was just after 7 p.m. No wonder everything seemed strange out there on the trail. We must have been knocked out for about 6 hours. And my cousins and I were very tired, so much so that we headed to our bunks right after eating. I was exhausted, but I couldn't fall asleep. In the morning, I was feeling very sluggish. My cousins slept until 11 a.m., and later in the day, we decided to tell our parents what happened on the trail. To be honest, our parents thought we were playing a stunt on them by concocting this wild story about being knocked out for 6 hours by a blast of energy. I was very upset with them, especially my dad, because he never let me forget about it. To this day, he still thinks it was a made-up story. My cousins and I still talk about what happened that day. We all feel that we were possibly abducted because of some of the weird dreams each of us has had since. Now, in 2005, I was diagnosed with leukemia, though I'm now in remission. One of my cousins was recently diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, while my other cousin has suffered kidney disease for over 10 years. We had all been 100% healthy before the incident on the trail. Though we have never seen any scars or marks on our bodies, we truly feel we were physically and mentally violated by something. And Sam wrote that. Now, I tell you that story, folks, not just because of who we're going to be interviewing today and what we're actually talking about, but because this happened as recently as July 31st. The story says, my name is D, and I really don't know how to describe what happened to me and three friends, but I'll try to do my best. We rented a cabin in the Cabwilingo State Forest from Friday, July 31st through Sunday, August 2nd. Everything was fine during the weekend until Sunday morning, or should I say Sunday night. We had a cookout on Saturday night and invited a few people we met. There were no problems, no drugs, just wine and food. We were all feeling fine, but not drunk. The cookout wound down about 2 a.m. and we were in our beds by 3. We had to be up, packed, and gone by 11. And we were planning on visiting friends before we made our way home. What happened next was totally bizarre. I remember waking up, then looking at my watch. It was 10:07, and it was dark. I looked at my friends, and all of them were sleeping, except Kay. She was sitting at the table and staring into the lantern, which was lit and sitting on the table. I jumped up and woke my friends. What the hell happened? My other friends, M and C, and the reason I'm using letters is because they didn't want all their names used, were just as surprised and confused as I. Kay didn't react to us. Even after we tried to question her, she almost looked like she was in shock. It was very warm in the cabin, but her skin was cold like ice and pale. We started to pack up so we could leave as soon as possible. We were on the road and headed home by midnight. All of us felt confused. We were all very thirsty also. We went through a six-pack of water very quickly. Kay was starting to respond to us and was looking better. It took about 2 hours to get home. We all lived in the same apartment complex, so we crashed at my place. None of us were tired, since we apparently had slept all day Sunday. But we were still very confused about not waking either. M thought that someone may have put something in the wine and that we had been drugged. And I suppose that was plausible, but I doubted this is what happened. As we sat in the living room talking, I noticed Kay had tears streaming down her face. I asked her why she was crying. She said that she knew what had happened. Now, first for all, I'm not worried about what people think about me, especially if this is true. The situation is different because I don't know how to ascertain if what I'm going to describe is the truth or not. I'm going to briefly detail what Kay said occurred. She remembers waking in the cabin to get a drink. She didn't know what it was, but she quickly noticed that something was wrong. She was alone in the cabin. Then suddenly an intense, bright yellow light flooded the cabin. She can't move, but she can see what is happening. We were back in our beds, but they were now three tall, purple-gray colored beings standing in front of her. Kay said these beings were about 8 foot tall and very thin. They had very large, dark oval eyes and a ray or fin that ran from the top of their heads down the middle of their back, which tapered off midway, that made no sounds and moved in a robotic fashion. Kay didn't recall anything else, other than that these beings eventually dissipated one by one. She did say that she had a sharp pain between her breasts. She was unable to move, or she was able to move, so she went and sat down at the table, and that's where she remained until I had woken. What is that, Kyle?
I have no idea. A crazy story, though. I enjoy it. I love the stories like this.
I found all this because, it made me think about what we're fixing to discuss with Joshua.
Yeah.
Is these cross things, or are these things, are they fae? Are they alien? What are they? Are they the exact same thing?
Yeah, or maybe they're just appearing to each person individually, separate, in their own thing. Like, in other words, to people 100 years ago, maybe it would be the incubus or a succubus, mm-hmm. and now it's an alien gray, or now it's or what used to be elves or gnomes is now an alien gray. You know, it's changed through mm-hmm. the times, much like we talk about the shape of UFOs has changed throughout time. I don't know. And what is this thing? It said it had like a fin on its head?
Yeah, something that runs like down it. Here's what's wild to me is, first of all, there was four of them.
Mm-hmm.
It only took three. It left Kay there.
Yeah.
In the details from the 91 episode, it only took three of them.
Right.
What is all that about? You know what I mean? It's so strange. It's only taken the three. The fourth was left behind. Why was she left behind?
You always leave one to tell the story.
Yeah, but you don't want that. You know, you never right. You never notice that. That's what's so crazy is they never, usually no one ever, you know, they wake up, they all have missing time. They don't know what happened, but she saw it, and it put her in such shock. What did they do to her?
Yeah, I don't
you
know.
Or did they take her and return her first, and then she came out of it? Or, you know, why didn't they take her? That's the thing that I have is why certain people get elected to be taken or looked upon, and others do not.
Well, you know, there's a lot of reports of the missing time, and that has a lot to do with the man we're going to be speaking about or speaking with today, Joshua Cutchin, in his new book, A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch. Now, in that book, I mean, they bring up there's a lot of cases of missing time
mm-hmm.
throughout all three, whether it's encounters with Sasquatch, encounters with fae folk, or encounters with aliens. There appears to be missing time. There appears to be food offerings. And what I like in the book is like how there are similarities between all three things. Now, you wouldn't think that fairies have anything to do with an encounter with Sasquatch or vice versa or with extraterrestrials, but there really are a number of similarities. Mm-hmm. Now, I remember a couple weeks ago I was reading one of the stories of the little girl that said that they had to have leave some plates of food out for her friends, and yeah. They were the little men, and at first the woman thought that they were rats.
Yes,
and it turned
yes.
out to be people. You know, when we've talked about, you know, stories where people thought that the Duende that they saw were raccoons, and then it's almost like these fae folk can, like, change the way you perceive them. Same thing with extraterrestrials when they make themselves look like owls.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you wonder, and I wonder if Sasquatch can do the same thing. Are these all similar things? Are they all tied to one another, and what was considered fae folk or gnomes is really one and the same with extraterrestrials, Sasquatch, whatever. I wonder if they're all the same. It just appears different to different people.
That's a good question.
You know, and even Joshua brings it up, you know. He's not sure that all encounters, you know, like we're talking about with Sasquatch, some of them definitely appear to be physical, but then other ones don't seem to be physical. So what is that? Or the same thing with the extraterrestrials. Yeah. Very interesting.
It's very interesting.
It's a really cool book. One of my favorites that I've read in the last year. Let's take a break. And when we get back, we're going to be speaking with Joshua Cutchin. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu. West Virginia, West Virginia.
All right, guys, if you can hear a little bit of that thunder just rolled in, we got a good friend of ours on the line. We're fixing to do a little discussion on his new book, which is an awesome new book,
right?
A Trojan Feast, Mr. Joshua Cutchin. Joshua, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great. It's a wonderful stormy night here in Georgia. I just saw some lightning, so you'll probably get some thunder in 3, 2. Of course, it doesn't show up when you want it to.
Yeah.
But I'm doing well. It's a great privilege to be here. I really love you guys' program, and you do good work.
Thank you, man. Well,
yeah.
This book is, well, first of all, we've talked about it on the show. Everybody knows that we're fae freaks. We're fae junkies, grown men into the fairies, as we were talking off air. But this book, I don't even know where to start, because on a lot of books that we cover and a lot of stories that we cover, you kind of have an idea of where you're going to go with it, where you're going to start, because you may not know exactly what angle they're going for, but you're really, really familiar with that information. Not this. This is something that, like we discussed, has been in front of us this whole time, but nobody kind of grasped a hold of it. And I have heard you say in other shows, the way it rolls in and ties in with the missing 411, it was like that. These stories were a lot along the same thing. You had this in front of you, and you pulled it out to talk about the food and the drink offerings of what we said was what? Alien, Sasquatch, and fairies.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost odd to me how long I sort of sat on this sort of idea and noticing this trend, which hopefully is going to be my credo as I go forward and into writing more books in the future. But these things that I've sat on and noticed, but I had been thinking about this for a while before I actually finally got the internal prodding to go ahead and write the book. And it's this cross-cultural phenomena, and there are some similarities there that I think are not inconsequential between all these different aspects of the phenomenon. And some of the ties are tighter than you'd think, and some of them are looser. But I think that there's a little bit of insight that can be gained from 14 phenomena in general from this one particular aspect.
Well, there's several ties that you've made in this book that, like I said, were there, but doesn't seem like anybody really realized it. I guess before we go, I mean, I know we're going to have to cover a lot here. So before we get into it, there's a lot of history that goes against taking this food or drink or anything from the Fae. And I guess we need to start there, because Fae is much older than, or the stories, let's say, of the Fae. And at least that's what we call them. We're not even sure what their real names are, because I know in a lot of the folklore, a lot of their real names weren't even allowed to be spoken. So it was given, we kind of gave them these names of the fairies. But I guess the history of the fact that you're not supposed to take food or anything from them, because it's much older than what we deal with if you get into the extraterrestrial thing.
Right. I mean, you know, that's where a lot of my inspiration has come from, the work of especially in particular Jacques Vallée, who drew a lot of these parallels between fairy folk and modern UFO lore. Mm-hmm. The occupants that have been seen, the wee folk, the fair folk, the good folk, the gentry, elemental spirits that are tied to the very earth. Christian theology will tell you either that they were the angels or the angels who were too bad for heaven and too good for hell and got shut out when the doors closed. But it's really tied more deeply into the idea of everything in nature having its own spirit, which dictate things like this wonderful thunderstorm, and really imbues all of that with its own character. And these are not, as we were speaking before the recording, these are not Tinkerbell. These are not tiny little things that tend to fly around. Some of them can be small, but some of them can be quite normal in terms of their height and not always nice, and quite frequently not nice, especially if you forget to leave out something for them to come in and bless your household. And by all means, if you ever ran into one of the Fae folk, if you were ever invited into a fairy mound, to a fairy party, or you were encountering a fairy walking along a deserted road at night, if you were offered something to eat or drink, you should not do so, because you'd be trapped with them forever.
Well, and it's funny to me, because I know that when people have been invited, at least the stories, the folk tales and the folk stories that we talk about, at least in those, when people have been invited in these fairy mounds and are on these big meetings of the Fae, time passes differently. And we were discussing that as time passes, either sometimes faster, slower, things like that, to where sometimes they feel like they've been gone for days. They may have only been gone a couple of minutes, or vice versa. They feel like they've only been there 5 minutes. They may have been gone for days. I know there was a story of a couple of fellas that were taken into a Fae, I guess, mound, is like a Fae party, and was fed and all that. And when they stepped out, you know, the story goes that they turned to dust. And it's strange, because this time travel, these time slips and things that people encounter, it almost seems like that ties into some of this.
Yeah, it really does. And it's interesting, you know, you talk about the idea of being trapped forever. And does that really mean forever, or does that mean that practically forever for those of us who are on this side of the the ethereal barrier. You know, if you go in and you have a drink with fairies and you think you're there for an hour and you've actually been in there 150 years, well, it might as well be forever for everybody that is out there who knows you. But yeah, it's a more exaggerated version of the sort of missing time that you find in UFO reports today. By and large, in UFO reports, you don't find people who think that they've spent hours and they've only spent minutes. You normally find people who think they've spent minutes and they've spent hours. In fairy folk lore, that's a much more loosey-goosey sort of metric. You have people who feel like they're experiencing short amounts of time and have actually experienced long amounts of time, and vice versa. In some ways, you could even interpret this as a motif that crosses over into Sasquatch lore. And I know that there are probably some people who've already put me into the spiritual Bigfoot camp. And while I'm sort of on the fence, I have to admit that there's a lot of parallels there. And you talk about people who feel like they've been looking, you know, staring at the Sasquatch in the woods for minutes, but they know it could have only been seconds. Well, is that maybe some sort of motif on missing time? There's some gentlemen who have a podcast who claim that their experience lasted 40 minutes, and it turns out it actually lasted 4 hours when seeing a Sasquatch. And these are on this particular broadcast, there's some folks who like to make fun of people who talk about the supernatural aspects of Bigfoot. And I'm sitting there going, guys, that's missing time right there. Mm-hmm. You got to admit that there's something not quite on the up and up about Bigfoot. And I don't know what that is. So,
well, and just like that is, as people, you hear all these stories about when people aim a rifle or something, they can't seem to bring themselves to do it. So I don't know if that's part of a time dilation that they're having problems with, or if that's part of the fact that we're closer connected to these things as far as being maybe soul to soul than what we are, as like we've discussed, crossing sides, because we've discussed it in the past. We've discussed the use of psychedelic drugs from time to time on this show. And it's funny because when people talk about using dimethyltryptamine, the DMT, or they talk about taking certain psychedelics, they talk about seeing machine elves. And we've even discussed that. And it almost feels like if there's a cellophane around you and you kind of poke out of that cellophane for just a little while and you see things that you normally wouldn't. And it almost feels like that's that connection, and like, oh, they can't believe it. And I even was talking to you about people seem like they're more in tune with nature whenever they end up seeing like a Bigfoot, or they're more in tune when they see these. And I don't mean that they see them and they become in tune. It seems like they are in tune, or more almost in a meditative state when they do that. Did you see, or any of the research that you've done, does it seem like these, if these beings, let's say the fairies, without getting into the aliens, because we know in the extraterrestrial stuff, we already know how they can control you or what's said to be controlled. Did you find in any of your fairy studies that it seems like they had an ability to control the people they come in contact with prior to engaging them with food or drink?
Well, you know, you really hear about that a lot, and it's interesting that you mention these sort of parallels. I mean, there are people who have been encountered entities under the effects of DMT and have been given food as well. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of things sort of falling into this in-between area. Well, it's not entirely this, it's not entirely this, maybe if it's a mix of both. But as far as the good folk being able to exert their will upon others, I mean, that's a very common theme, usually in the British Isles being called pixie-led, which, again, has those sort of missing 411 ties, where people are just find themselves going down a road that they have never gone down before because they feel drawn to go down it, and then they have their experience. Again, shades of the abduction narrative, mm-hmm. where people tend to go down roads where they've never gone in their car and end up in an isolated stretch and are taken. So not only that, but there also is this curious this curious phenomena where I find it hilarious that the food taboo exists, because most of us don't have to be told to not take food from strange humans, nonetheless strange little people that we meet in the forest.
Good point.
Aliens or Sasquatch, you know. So I think that there's got to be some sort of influence upon one's consciousness, which again opens up this whole chestnut of the role that consciousness plays in this. And you know, I tend to not stake my ground too firmly in any of these particular camps. But I will say that at the end of the day, once we boil all this down, consciousness is going to play a big role. I don't know what it is. I don't know how it interfaces. I think that there's an objective component, but I think that there's an extremely subjective component as well.
I also want to say, like, there's a lot of similarities between the fae folk and the stories and some of the things that David Politis mentions in 411. It seems like a lot of people get in touch or actually see some of these fairies when they're in either boulder patches, berry patches, mm-hmm. picking berries. It's bizarre, like, how many similarities there are. And even in his books, they talk about when they find some of these children, the children are kind of drowsy, or they might be running a fever, or there's inclement weather. It's, like, really bizarre. And what are some of the things that you've found through your research, Joshua, that the fae folk offer people?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you have to sort of view this through not only a very critical lens in terms of categorization, but also through a historic lens. I mean, if you look at the offerings that would be expected to be given during medieval times, which is where the lion's share of fairy accounts come from, you wouldn't expect them to be giving water, because water just really wasn't that sanitary
right.
at the time. You know, ale and wine were the really preferred methods of hydrating yourself because of the fermentation process would actually kill a lot of that bacteria. Having said that, fae folk would tend to give ale or wine or milk, or in some cases, if you want to think about it, think about wine being a variation on fruit juice. In the vast majority of all these subjects across all these, you know, alien and fairy lore, a vast majority of what is given is liquid, like by like maybe 60 to 40 in terms of liquid, 60% liquid versus 40% everything else. After those liquids, fae folk would tend to give grains. They would tend to give bread or even grain itself, like a buckwheat or something. And then after that, there's a pretty sharp decline in what they would offer. Modern day abduction reports, again, liquid. Contactee reports, liquid. Abduction reports tend to be bitter, uncomfortable, force-fed foods, or liquids rather, and contactee reports from the golden age of the contactees tend to be voluntarily consumed sweet fruit juices. And again, there's a sort of taper off with bread, and then abduction and contactee lore tend to elaborate on vegetables and fruits that are given. Again, this weird vegetarian / vegan through line, which I address in the book.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, of course, the things that you would expect with abduction reports, pills, you know, it's something that's a very common thing as well. But across the board, with the exception of Sasquatch abduction tales, which we can address this, Sasquatch enters the conversation because of some similarities between the food taboo, but sort of over time exits the conversation because of the lack of consistency. But you hardly ever see fairies or aliens giving meat or giving candy,
mm-hmm.
which I think is really interesting in the Western world, because you'd think that we are a really meat and candy obsessed culture. I know that I am.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you'd think that that would be reflected, if this was a purely psychological phenomenon, that would be reflected more in the types of things that people are given. But, you know, they're not.
Yeah, but pancakes, right? Some of the aliens like to serve up pancakes.
Yes, the pancakes. The poster child of the entire phenomenon, Joe Simonton.
Yeah, could you tell our listeners about that?
That's a great story. It really is a great story.
I'd love to. And it's so great because it seems so earnest, you know? It's almost like this tale of Americana in some ways. A chicken farmer from Eagle River, Wisconsin, on April 18th, 1961, was making breakfast, and he hears this strange sound like radials on wet pavement. He looks outside, and there's these inverted bowl shapes forming a saucer that has landed on his lawn. And there's some guy that he said looked like an Italian. Three Italian-looking guys, about 5 feet tall, and one of them was holding a this jug and was gesturing for what he thought was water. So I love the next line in his logic. He's like, well, if they are asking for water, I guess I better give them some water.
Help them out.
Yeah. Oh, you betcha. So he goes out there and he grabs the jug, and he comes back in and he fills the jug with water and returns and notices. It doesn't even seem like it was part of the original intent of these beings to give him this, but he notices that they're cooking pancakes, some alternately described as cookies, but these porous pancakes on this flameless griddle. And apparently they notice him being curious about it, and they offer him four of these things. And he takes them, and he shares them with Hynek, he shares them with Nycap, He keeps one and he gives one to a local judge. And he says that they taste awful. And when they're analyzed, they are determined to have completely mundane earthly ingredients, but they're completely tasteless. Now, I've heard a rumor since the book came out that supposedly there's a museum or like a glass display case in the cafeteria of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and supposedly one of these is on display there. I have no of backing
that up. I hope so.
I hope so. It's right beside that little it's right beside the mummy from the Roswell slides, I'm sure.
Right. I love this story. Simply the main reason why is because it's mundane everyday things that's made up this pain. Because in my way of thinking, which is really, really off center, everybody knows that, but it would be something that would be a mundane thing, because if these beings are truly elementals and truly tied to this planet the way that they're more in tune with it, they wouldn't have anything from space or any outlandish ingredients. They would just be good, down home, wholesome ingredients. Because the thing that gets to me is this: in your story or in your book, a lot of the stories they come across deal with farmers. And anytime you think of that, I always think of who is more in tune with the earth, who's more keeping up with the almanac, the weather, knowing when to plant, as close to the fae as they themselves are, would probably be a farmer.
Absolutely. I mean, these were the people who were relying upon the generosity of the fairies back in medieval times, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It could be disastrous if a farmer were to forget to put out the proper offering for the fairies. They could blight their crops. They could steal the very essence of their harvest at a whim.
That right there. That's what I want you to talk about. The fact that it's not just them giving us stuff, but the fact that we have to give them something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting. Every fairy had its own sort of list of offerings that it would prefer, and it was, the certain Russian house fairies would have to have this, and certain Italian fairies would literally want some macaroni, and certain pixies would prefer warm milk or something along those lines. And these were things that you would leave out at night. And once you return the next day, if you were to see that it was still there, it wasn't that they didn't take it. It was that they came in and actually took the essence, the foison of the food, of the fairy food. And, as I've said a couple of times on different in different conversations that I've had, my inherently skeptical side has to go, well, of course that's the excuse, because the food's still there. You say, oh, well, they did, they came along and they didn't take the offering, but they took the essence of the offering. So we'll pour it out. But the interesting thing to me is that once the essence was taken from these foods, it was not fit for consumption by any living being. And there are plenty of anecdotes of cats and dogs who eat meat that has been deprived of its foison, its essence, by the fairies, and end up getting sick. And I can't help but see a parallel between that and a lot of livestock mutilation cases.
Mm-hmm.
Where scavengers will actually deliberately avoid mutilated cattle.
Well, and when you talk about the foison in the book, it instantly made me think of what Kyle had brought up too. But I had thought about it while reading the book. Is that why the children come out feeling groggy? Are they stealing some of the foison, the essence, from those children? Is that what they're using us for? Is they're using us for a little bit of stealing our power? And it's the fact that when these older people go missing, they can't survive that, the rigors of going back and forth, crossing that line into that other reality and having that done to them and then being returned, as compared to, the younger people may be able to survive that.
That's a fantastic idea. It really is. And you think, it really dovetails quite nicely with a lot of things that you hear, because you hear people talking about aliens and Sasquatch and whatnot taking people for food purposes. And I'm sort of, I'm on the fence on it, sort of dubious overall about that. But it also dovetails nicely with this, like, you keep on hearing them talking about men in black or black-eyed children feeding on our fear. Well, what does that really mean? Well, maybe that means some sort of variation on foison. So I think you're definitely onto something like that. And I would put that in writing ASAP before I steal it.
And one of the interesting thing is the stories of the men in black that they think I've read something about them offering them Jell-O and stuff, and they didn't really know how to eat it and stuff. So I think those
throw them a curveball with
the food and things. It's really remarkable. And you briefly talk in the book about Sasquatch and stuff, and I know Cam has brought up the case of Albert Osman, and when he was kidnapped and abducted by the Sasquatch. Could you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Albert Ostman is sort of the one of the more famous Sasquatch abduction stories. One thing that I mentioned in the book is that, you know, Sasquatch abduction stories are hard to come by to begin with, and they're even harder to find credible ones of, and even harder within that entire subset of finding ones where someone is offered some sort of food and drink. But Ostman was one of those really high profile cases. The jury's still sort of out on the validity of it. John Green thought that Albert Ostman's report was you know, worth investigation. Rene de Hinden thought that it had changed too much over the years and that it was a load of bunk. But having said that, Ostman actually swore in an affidavit in 1957 that he had actually been taken by a Sasquatch family 33 years prior, and that he was sleeping, and he was picked up in his sleeping bag and carried to a small valley where four Sasquatch that he assumed were a family unit kept him alive, and they actually kept him sort of captive. And over several days, they gave him some sort of sweet roots with that he said had a quote-unquote satisfying taste, and they allowed him to stay alive. So, again, this sweet profile shows up in a lot of these cases of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch. And again, there's the vegetarian angle as well, which I don't think can be overlooked. It's interesting because, you know, Ostman ended up using consumable provisions from his pack to get away from the Sasquatch. He got the father to eat his can of snuff, and after the father Sasquatch ate the can of snuff, He drank some steaming hot coffee and grounds and all, and supposedly that was his cue to escape, and it generated an opportunity for him.
Well, I'll tell you something else I really enjoyed about the book is the fact that you brought up it's a really strange thing, and it's one of those things that I don't guess anybody would have thought about this while we're sitting here talking about the Fae and even the Sasquatch, is the Ayurvedic diet that it seems like these things all circle around.
Yeah, that's really something that I feel like there is something to that, because mm-hmm. I have never been particularly into Eastern philosophy. I don't mean that necessarily in a pejorative way. It's never really until I started looking into this, it hadn't really been part of my set of interests. And I started looking into some globally held ideas that certain foods are hot or cold, that certain foods can change your disposition. And one of the most robust traditions with this is the Ayurvedic philosophy of eating, which says that certain foods that you eat can actually correspond to your mental and physical state. Foods are deemed either to be sattvic, tamasic, or rajasic. And tamasic foods are negative foods. They're processed foods. In a lot of Hindu traditions, they're meats, spoiled foods, canned foods, processed foods, etc. Rajasic foods are foods that tend to incite the passions. So not entirely bad. We all need them, according to a lot of Ayurvedic philosophers. We all need them to sort of carry about the day-to-day necessities. But there are things like alcohol and spices and certain meats and certain other like garlic, heartburn inducing foods mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. And then at the top of this is the sattvic diet, which maps on almost perfectly to all the things that you find in fairy, alien, and Sasquatch lore, which are the best food are fruit juices, which we already talked about, you know, fruity liquids, wines and liquids like that being the most common food that you run across. Second is grain. Third is milk. You know, it really maps on quite nicely. And the fascinating thing about that is that it's a diet that, according to Ayurvedic philosophy, is actually the diet that seers and clairvoyants and mystics should adopt and do end up adopting as part of their spiritual journey. And this is where, you know, things get a little bit uncomfortable for the nuts and bolts ufology crowd, because, hate to tell you, a lot of abductees claim to have, poltergeist-like experiences and moments of clairvoyance and things like that. So it's interesting to see where this tends to overlap, there seems to be a very spiritual component to all this. Again, I'm not sold on that fact, but you got to acknowledge it's an interesting coincidence.
Well, and then you talk about what they believe, that the seers, the people that can have these extra sensory perceptive powers, should adopt a certain diet. It's funny that it kind of ties hand in hand with what's been given. But now you've touched on the UFO angle, so we're going to have to get into it now. Now you brought up, we're going to have to get into the fact of just how, first of all, let everybody know there's a percentage that you give of that the majority is of fluid. Now, it's not necessarily given nicely, like we like to believe the Fae. Most of the time it's forced, but it almost seems like it's, after about 1960, it took a nasty turn, and they got tired of us messing around and got tired of wanting to give out hugs after the flower power, and they decided they were just going to go ahead and mainline the juice to us then.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's I feel like a lot of things, well, I feel like a lot of things got worse after the 60s, but
music. Okay.
Yeah, fair enough. You know, it's interesting because it's this sort of, I've talked about this before, this recontextualization. You know, things in this phenomena tend to be what we expect them to be, and a lot of the people who report being an abductee reports have often been like had a tube shoved down their throat and liquid pumped into their stomach, or have been given a ball gag with some liquid given to them forcibly. And again, you can look at injections is sort of a variation on this. You know, there's a substance that is going into your body. I'm interested. I think it's really interesting how there is a consistency across, I mean, as we mentioned, the consistency between medieval fairy lore and modern abduction lore, it's striking. But in some ways, there's a profound lack of consistency that seems really married to where we are as a global civilization and what our expectations are.
What you just brought up is something that I never thought of. I never thought of pills. You touch on that in the book. And I never thought of injections.
Yeah.
But it's exactly the same thing. It's something that, it's funny that we think that, well, because we take it in the mouth, it's, you know, we can drink it, it's okay. But when it's injected, it's the same thing. You're still taking it into the body, maybe not directly into the bloodstream, but it's going to get there sooner or later. You're still going to take something in like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of those reasons that I was kind of gun shy of really putting any hard numbers on any of my findings, because the lines, they start to tend to blur. You know, you have people who remember eating something. Well, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't fit into a spreadsheet all that well. And then you look at people who are given injections. Is that a variation? And then something that's a major point of conversation in my book is the idea of ointments perhaps being another variation on ingestion. You know, there's a lot of corroborating evidence that whatever these entities, which we call aliens, which is not an endorsement of the extraterrestrial hypothesis, just for the sake of argument, calling them aliens. There's a lot of evidence that the epidermis plays a strong role in their means of consumption, which, again, ties into fairy folklore, where supposedly this foison was taken directly through the porous skin of the fairies. In which case, if they consume through their skin, well, what does that mean when they put an ointment on you after they take you into your ship?
Yeah, that's very true. I'm sitting here thinking about it. I'm like, that is very, it's disturbing, because what instantly hit me was the thought of the brownies, because they always talk about when people would claim to see what they called the Fae as the brownies, their skin was very leathery and porous looking. And I'm like, well, maybe it does. It kind of ties in. I got another quick question. And I can't remember what you called, because I had never heard this, the fact that people claim that they see food, but it turns out to be like a mead jug full of spiders and frogs, or it may be full of barks and leaves. It's almost like it's playing a joke. And I know in one of the stories, someone had ate it, and then when they got sick and threw up, that it was like pieces of bark and grass and sticks.
Yeah, I mean, I think this ties really into our conversations about consciousness and, you know, cultural expectations of what we're supposed to see. You look at a lot of these fairy foods that were given, and oftentimes they would be claimed to be cloaked in this aura of glamour, which makes something look more appealing than it truly is. There's a Finnish tale where the hero in the epic takes a tankard of ale, and it turns out to be worms and frogs. There's another story where someone finds out that the fairy banquet before them is leaves and twigs. And again, this interesting tie-in, a lot of times Sasquatch and Native American lore would offer you food, but it turned out, supposedly it was dried salmon, but it turned out to be tree bark. So there's this interesting idea that what you're seeing is not what you get. And of course, if it applies to the food, it likely applies to the entities themselves. And, you know, it's really interesting because this idea of not seeing what you get and the food actually being something that isn't what it appears ties in again to the Joe Simonton thing, which is these looked like they should have been tasty pancakes or tasty cookies, as they were. And he said that they tasted like nothing. So one wonders if they, you know, not that they were really not that they were really something else cloaked to be buckwheat pancakes like they turned out to be from the analysis, but rather that, you know, it's this idea of this food having no real substance to it, you know, having no real voice in or essence in it.
Yeah. And you even bring up the ointment and rubbing of tree sap on people's eyes gives them some kind of ability to see through the veil. Can you describe that?
Yeah, it's another one of those variations on the whole ointment idea, where in order to take in this hidden world, you had to have fairy ointment rubbed on your eyes. There are quite a few stories where a fairy would either reward or punish, depending on the interactions in the story, someone by putting ointment on their eyes and allowing them to see the hidden world. Another interesting parallel with Sasquatch. In some Native American lore, the Tsunokwa would actually trap young children, grab them and slap tree gum on their eyes, the gum from a tree. And that's something that supposedly happened in the tale of Seraphine Long, which is actually much older than the Albert Ostman story. She was a Native American girl who said that she had been held prisoner by a large hairy hominid. And every time it would take her to its cave, it would slap tree gum on her eyes. And eventually she got pregnant from this thing, supposedly, and begged to be taken back to her village. And it slapped tree gum on her eyes again and brought her back. So these interesting ideas of ointment and somehow needing to have your eyes concealed with this special medicine to reveal the hidden world is another through line through all this.
That's incredible. I do like how in the book you bring up the fact that I never really realized it until you wrote this, is that like the earlier cases of the contactees from like, you know, the Betty and Barney Hill cases, they were almost offered these things generously, like, please, would you like to have a drink? Would you like to have some of this? And then it was forced on them closer to modern day abductees. And it doesn't seem to be the same case in the fairy realm. It still seems like, and I'm going to have to be honest, if I'm bebopping around in the woods and I come across a couple of gnomes or some fairies, and they invite me to a fairy party, it's going to be really hard for me to turn that down.
Oh, for real.
Right? I mean, I don't want to be a party pooper. I'm going to be like, man, all right.
Especially if you catch Kyle about six beers in, he's going to be like, hell
then
yeah.
It's impossible.
It's Frank the Tank. You're going to get Frank the Tank at the party. Frank the Tank. And he's going to be ready to rock with the fae folk.
I'm just being honest. It's going to be hard to turn down some fairy mead or some bread or a little cupcake. I'd be like, all right.
A fairy edible.
It's interesting that you mention that because, you know, there's what was her name? There was a young lady who ate some bread. Anne Jeffries, that was a famous fairy contactee person. In 1645, she claimed to have a relationship with the fairies, and they would give her bread to eat. And supposedly she offered it to her employer. And he said that it was the most delicious bread he ever had in his entire life. So yeah, I mean, it would be tough to turn that down. It's interesting, you know. It's you mentioned this about having a couple of drinks. I also can't help but see a lot of parallels between the types of folks that that fairies would pick on in medieval times and the sort of folks that get picked on, you know, in abduction lore. It's people who are marginalized. In fairy lore, it was people who like to drink. Being fairy struck meant not only being paralyzed by a fairy, but could also be a euphemism for getting too drunk. And I wonder sometimes, is it just people who are delusional, or is it people who are deliberately singled out to be less credible? You know, well, no one will believe this guy because he comes home home drunk all the time. But, you know, it's interesting. The fairy stuff always seems very much in good nature, you know.
Well,
and they invite you in and they offer you a drink, and if I'm not even sure it's always being offered with some sort of negative motive, you know?
Well, and you talk about it is bringing up the fact of the drinking. It still instantly makes me think that, in a way, drinking expands your consciousness. And lots of times it drops boundaries that you have on yourself. I know people that are, you know, the old saying is a drunk person's actions is a sober person's thoughts. And it's because lots of times it'll drop those barriers. And I know in the book you speak of ayahuasca. Now, Kyle and I, neither one have taken it. Now, we know people that have. But it almost seems like anything that will lower inhibitions and maybe force you in some chemical fashion if you can't find it on your own through meditation or anything else, but force you to open your eyes and open your mind almost seems like that's another way that they find a way to get in. They're like, well, this person's susceptible to it, or, hey, this person can see us, or, you know, something along those. It's almost like you kind of get dialed into that wavelength.
No, that's a very good point. And, you know, I identify as a Christian myself, and it's interesting that that communion is supposed to include wine. And I think Carl Jung actually said that it should be completely outlawed in Christianity to ever consume anything other than wine, because that was part of the experience being drawn closer to God, was the sort of quasi entheogenic aspects of alcohol. I do say quasi because it's nothing near like the experiences that you hear with ayahuasca, where people are literally transported to different realms where they encounter different beings who tend to know everything about their lives. You know, it's interesting. I did have the pleasure of speaking with a gentleman from Ireland who made a regular trips to Cusco and for ayahuasca sessions. And he said that there was one session where he was actually asked to a party to go have a drink with an elf. And his supervising shaman just flipped his lid and ran out and rescued him before he was about to go through the door that appeared in the ground while under ayahuasca. And his shaman came and got him. So, you know, again, I don't. It's funny because if you ate fairy food and didn't come back, I don't think we'd have any stories whatsoever. So I don't think that's necessarily a one-to-one truth, as it were. I think that there's something, you know. Maybe it means that you're changed forever or something, but there's something there.
Well, and I like the fact that even in wrapping up and things that you discuss and tying up loose ends in the book and things, it still seems to be, and you keep bringing it up now, is there's something that's tied to consciousness. And it seems to be, people are tired of hearing this, and I know because I've talked about it on the show a few times, but I've done the float tanks, the where you get into the float tank, you know, and you're in total darkness and all this and total suspended. And when I got out of the tank several times, you get out of the tank, you forget things. Like you're in a haze. It literally took me 15 or 20 minutes to realize that I was physically out of the tank, that I wasn't just imagining it. And it was a very strange thing for me. And I can't really equate it to anything else. No kind of, you know, no drugs, no alcohol, no meditation, no anything. It was completely different. And that just keeps running through my head every time when I think about them finding these people, you know, that have claimed that they've been around the Fae. It's almost like you've been taken, physically taken somewhere else, but not just that. Like, if you want to believe that your soul resides in your body, or if it comes from whatever it is, your essence, whatever it is, almost like it all goes with you in this other place and scrambles you up for a second. Like you're not attuned to it. And we've even discussed off air, we were talking about the calcification of the pineal gland that may be thousands of years ago, thousands of whatever you want to say, millennia ago, we weren't this way. That we actually, that was actually part of our everyday life, this interaction with these people and these beings. And maybe, you know, as time went on,
and interaction food, with nature, yeah.
Exactly, and our food and our evolution, whatever it was, has caused us to lose that contact. Kyle and I have talked several times about the black-eyed children on this show, and the fact that I even brought up, and me and him laughed about it, could they be the evil side of the Fae? And they used to come dressed as people back in the past because that's how they related to them. And now, like I said, if they come as children now, you don't think anything of it. How many times have you walked past a young person with a hoodie and a headphones on, and they go right by you on the street, and you never look at their eyes? You don't know. Maybe they're Fae. That's what that is. It's a black-eyed kid as part of a lineage of Fae, and this is how they're relating to us now, the same as the Greys or something. It's just how this whole thing evolves seems to be around our consciousness, almost like we project it upon ourselves.
Completely. I mean, you couldn't have put it better. I couldn't have put it better myself, rather. You know, I feel like we definitely have erected walls around ourselves. I think there are a lot of things that contribute to this. I think calcification of the pineal gland is part of it. I think, you know, the fact that it doesn't take us any amount of time to travel anywhere. You know, we don't spend time traveling in the wilderness anymore. We're not walking along secluded country lanes, and we're not in a horse and buggy anymore. We don't spend time in those wild areas.
We don't spend time as tribes or family anymore.
Oh, yeah.
The interlacing. We have all this social media, but we're not social animals anymore.
Yeah, no, that's something that you know, I've chosen to be a Luddite myself. I still do not have a smartphone. I've
holding out with the flip phone.
Yeah, still rocking the flip phone, partially because I realize that I will be that person who has their face buried in their phone. But, you know, I think we're continuing to go this route, you know, of continuing to wall ourselves off. I think that the fact that we don't have, you know, the second sleep, like the I believe it was the Weir studies who were talking about, you know, people waking up in the middle of the night and actually having time in the middle of the night to be awake and to meditate and to contemplate. I think that's a part of it. I think a part of it is also the fact that we are surrounded by this invisible network of electricity and Wi-Fi. You know, I think all of these things have contributed to us not seeing these things. And you think about where people do see these things nowadays. They're always on the margins. They're in old abandoned haunted buildings. They're always in the wilderness, you know, a lonely road where they're abducted. And I think there's something quite compelling about that. I think there's something very important in that we are not paying attention to.
No, I think you're exactly right. Now, Joshua, where can people find the book, and what are your future plans? What else you got going on?
Well, they can find the book. It's available from Amazon and Barnes & Noble. I have a website set up called joshuacutchin.com. Appropriately enough, I try to blog there about once a week, different thoughts that are roaming through my head. Up next is, you know, I really am trying to look at aspects of this that I don't think that people are really looking at closely enough, as it's probably evidenced by anybody who has followed anything that I've done. I like to try to find the through line, not that I'm trying to find a theory of everything in terms of this paranormal field, but I do think that all these things in some form or fashion are related. Whether or not, as I've said multiple times, that means multiple things using similar techniques or the same thing using the same techniques, I'm not sure, but I think that there's some connection there. So my next book, I'm really deep in the weeds on it. I'm probably going to make an announcement on my website coming up here in a couple of weeks about what that is, but it's looking again at something that has been sort of winding its way through all this stuff that no one has ever sat down and said, let's take a look at this and let's really hash it out. So,
that sounds
I'm
incredible.
Being a bit coy, but
yeah. Well, please let us know whenever you decide what you're going to come out with. I'm excited to read about it. Thank you so much for coming on today, and thank you so much for writing this book. It really was interesting, much like Cam was talking about. We get so many books that I kind of know where they're going before I ever get them, and this one was a complete surprise. What a gem.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And Expanded Perspectives is doing a great job at what you do. You guys are scratching an itch that I think needs to be scratched.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, you're welcome.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
We'll be right back.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Thank you very much, Joshua Cutchin, for coming on the show and talking about that book. Now, if you want to pick that book up, don't forget, you can go to Anomalous Books. I'll put links to it in the show notes, and you can get it there. It's a very interesting read. I suggest you pick it up. Cam, what are your thoughts?
I love it. It's just anything with the Fae and all the fun that we had. We talked to Joshua off air, and yeah, I think I'm fixing to really start knuckling down and putting one together. I've got a bunch of ideas and a bunch of stuff saved, and you know, all this information on stuff with the Fae and things that I've been wanting to do for about a year now. And so after talking to Joshua and a few other pushes, but Joshua was the man that pushed me over the line, so I guess I'm going to go ahead and start, which in turn means I'm fixing to hold you accountable for you to start yours too.
Writing a book?
So, yeah.
So, yeah, if I have enough time, I got to wait. It's baseball season's about to start. If I can find enough time.
No rest for the wicked, my friend.
I would love to be able to put together this book that I've had thoughts about for a couple years. I'm not going to tell anybody what it is because yeah. I don't want somebody to steal it and then write it before I do, because they definitely probably can, because I'm a slow mover when it comes to stuff like this.
Right.
But very interesting. I would love to see if you could put together a book about the Fae folk. I know you have numerous stories and numerous journals and articles that you've been saving for quite a while on the subject.
It. Oh, I got something real quick, too, I want to drop on everybody.
Yeah,
folks,
go ahead.
Anybody here that's a local, I would say anybody in the DFW area, if you just enjoy it and want to come out, I'm going to be at the Guys and Dolls Ballroom there in Fort Worth on Friday, September 18th. And the reason I'm going is because one of my training partners is actually fighting, and this may be his last amateur fight. He may end up be turning pro after this. But if anybody's interested and they want to go watch and you just want to hang out, I'm going to be there just chilling, watching some fights. I may actually be drinking.
I don't know where this was going at the beginning of that. What's the name of the place?
The name of the place is Guys and Dolls Ballroom.
Wow.
You've been. That's where you and your wife met. Anyway, if y'all go, I don't have any affiliation with it, but you can go and check it out. You can search it up. It's on the belts of Hieronymus or Heronius, whatever. I don't know how they pronounce that crap. But anyway, cagetix.com. And you can see it. But anyway, that's what we're going to be there. I may get Kyle to go. I'm going to try to talk him into going with us and all that stuff. But if you want to come hang out and have a few drinks, I know Caesar over there in Dallas, he may end up showing up. I'll get a hold of him.
Right on.
Caesar and him and
his lady
friend.
Don't forget, if you want to hang out with me and Cam, we are going to both be at the Paradigm Symposium in
Very
Minneapolis.
Very true.
October 1st through 4th. You can go to the ParadigmSymposium.com. And
I'm stoked about
tickets.
The food, man. I can't wait. I'm a fatty, so I like to eat. I'm really excited about that whole thing, too.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Now, Kyle was telling me something, Kyle. I'm kind of a shy guy, Kyle. What can you help me out there with?
Oh, are you talking about this new video that teaches shy guys how to get literally any woman they want?
Yes.
Yeah, I saw the ads on this. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's another one of these, you know, these books for these guys, these poor guys that keep buying this stuff.
We get crazy emails. I mean, because of the show, we get insane emails with, like, the money. People want to give you money. And then you get stuff like links like this.
Yeah, the guy wants to come on Expanded Perspectives and talk about secret tips of these pickup artists for women. And so I'm like, does the guy not listen to the show? That has nothing to do with what we talk about.
No.
Remember the one guy that sent us the email about having us on about a trip to Patagonia?
Yeah.
We're like, no, I don't think that's not a good fit for our show. I appreciate the offer. And the guy's like, well, why don't you have me on anyways? We'll just see if your listeners want to listen to it. I'm like, no.
Yeah.
How about no?
No. So, but you know what I am? I'm curious. Maybe it's because Kyle and I are awful shy, as y'all can all kind of gather. We're awful shy. We already know the secret to a woman's heart. You treat her nice and you have a lot of money, you're good. Bingo. Score. Pow.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's not sexist,
that's
is it?
No. Is that wrong? Am I wrong? Girls, come on. You don't like guys with money? Come on. Who don't like money?
Anyways, moving on. Hey, if you guys got any stories of your own or show ideas, don't forget you can email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. You can follow us personally. You know the deal.
Yeah.
Don't work too hard this week. Have a good week. And for you elite members, we'll be speaking to you on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll speak to you next Monday. Take care.
Peace. We'll be right back.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.